We can't beat God. He's always going to win in the end. And you know, there was a time in my life when hearing that would have made me mad. I didn't want God in my life. I didn't want him messing with me. I wanted him to go bother some other planet of people. But when I got to know him through Jesus Christ and I began to understand his true intentions and his love for me, I had a profound change of heart. I want him to always win now. I want him to always win now. Even when it means that I might lose in the immediate. He only has the very best in mind for me. So when he wins, I win. Joseph's family is on their way to discovering that truth today. If you've got your Bible, flip over to Genesis chapter 41, and we'll be picking our story up there where we left off last time. When Joseph was a teenager, the Lord gave him a couple of unique dreams which revealed his future. One day, his family would all be bowing down before him as a superior authority over them. But almost everything in Joseph's life so far has suggested that that was a pipe dream rather than a prophetic vision of his future. Joseph has spent the past 13 years of his life as a slave and a prisoner in Egypt. It has been as far as away as imaginable from what he saw in those dreams years before. No one has been bowing down before him. Instead, he has done a whole lot of bowing down to others. But at the close of the story last time, it looks like Joseph's ship may have finally come in. 2 years earlier in the prison, while attending to the needs of two special prisoners, the royal cupbearer and the royal baker, Joseph was able, through the help of God, to accurately interpret dreams that these two men had. The dream the cupbearer had, it predicted that he would get his job back with the Pharaoh. The dream of the baker predicted that he would be executed. Both predictions came true in every detail. Well, the royal cupbearer had agreed to bring Joseph's case before Pharaoh to try to get him released from prison. But the cupbearer forgot all about Joseph once he was comfortably back in the palace. And then one day, Pharaoh had two very disturbing dreams himself. He knew the dreams had some kind of meaning. He knew they were important. But none of his dream experts, his magicians, his wise men could give the meaning of the dreams. Well, that jarred the memory of the royal cupbearer, who remembered how Joseph had interpreted his and the baker's dreams 2 years earlier in prison. So the cupbearer told Pharaoh about Joseph, and Joseph was immediately brought into the palace before Pharaoh. And that's where we pick our story up today, Genesis 41, beginning in verse 14. It says, "So Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and he was quickly brought from the dungeon. When he had shaved and changed his clothes, he came before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'I had a dream, and no one can interpret it. But I have heard it is said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it.' 'I cannot do it,' Joseph replied to Pharaoh, 'but God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires.'" Well, Joseph, he has a perfect opportunity here to talk himself up in front of Pharaoh. Many people would have done exactly that. Imagine yourself standing in front of one of the most powerful men in the world, and he hands you this huge compliment about your reputation as a dream interpreter. And the temptation would be there to answer him with a big affirmative, saying, "Oh, yes, Mr. Pharaoh, I am indeed just as great as you heard." Joseph, he doesn't do that. Instead of using it as an opportunity to talk himself up, he uses it as an opportunity to talk God up. You know, Jesus said in Matthew 23:12, "Those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." Talk the Lord up. Give him credit. and let him take care of talking you up. There are two things we can observe in Joseph's response to Pharaoh here, which are key for us to be used by God too. The first thing he says, I cannot do it. Joseph recognizes his own weakness and inability to do what Pharaoh is asking him to do. He can't interpret the dreams of Pharaoh. You have the desire, perhaps, to be used by God, but you think, well, he can't use me because I don't have enough talent. I don't have enough faith. I don't have enough compassion. I don't have enough knowledge. I don't have enough commitment. I don't have enough patience. I don't have enough love. I don't have enough, insert whatever it is that you don't have enough of. That's a fantastic beginning. You have taken the first important step. You recognize that you don't have enough. I don't have enough either. Welcome to the club of people who don't have enough. Guess who else is in that club? Every person ever used by the Lord throughout history. People like Joseph and Abraham and Tamar and Moses and Joshua and Rahab and Hannah, Samuel, David, Solomon, Mary, John, Peter, Paul. None of them had enough. The second thing that Joseph does here is he says, God will provide Pharaoh the answer he desires. Joseph knows who does have the ability to do it. Joseph is convinced of God's ability and God's willingness to do it. These two things are really two sides of a single coin, and that coin is called faith. Faith, Bible faith, recognizes our own weakness and inability and at the same time believes in God's power and willingness to act. Now, that's a very different understanding of faith than what we commonly hear talked about in our culture. We often hear people say, you have to have faith. And when they say that, they're saying you have to have faith in your own abilities and trust in your own instincts, believing it will work out somehow in the end. It's a faith that is centered on yourself. And that's the opposite of what the Bible means when it talks about faith. The faith in the Bible that we're talking about here is a faith that is centered on the Lord. That's the kind of faith that Joseph has. Joseph has his confidence centered in what the Lord is able and willing to do rather than himself. Verse 17, it says, then Pharaoh said to Joseph, in my dream I was standing on the bank of the Nile, when out of the river there came up seven cows, fat and sleek, and they grazed among the reeds. After them seven other cows came up, scrawny and very ugly and lean. I had never seen such ugly cows in all the land of Egypt. The lean, ugly cows ate up the seven fat cows that came up first. But even after they ate them, no one could tell that they had done so. They looked just as ugly as before. Then I woke up. So here's Pharaoh's first dream. And the first group of seven cows are described as fat and sleek, or well-fed and healthy-looking, or plump and attractive, fine-looking and fat. We don't hear beautiful things described like that much in our culture. But that's the way they're described here. Versus the second group of seven cows who are described as scrawny and very ugly and lean, poor, very ugly and thin. That's more the way our culture describes beautiful things. It's like these are the supermodel cows, these thin, ugly ones. And these thin, ugly cows, they eat the beautiful, plump cows and are no better afterward. They're still thin and ugly. 22. In my dream, I saw seven heads of grain, full and good, growing on a single stalk. After them, seven other heads sprouted, withered and thin and scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the seven good heads. I told this to the magicians, but none of them could explain it to me. So in this second dream, The cast of characters involve heads of grain rather than the cows. And it says, none of Pharaoh's experts in these things can explain the meaning of the dreams. 25, then Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one and the same. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads of grain are 7 years. It is one and the same dream. The seven lean, ugly cows that came up afterward are 7 years, and so are the seven worthless heads of grain scorched by the east wind. They're 7 years of famine. It is just as I said to Pharaoh, God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. 7 years of great abundance are coming throughout the land of Egypt, but 7 years of famine will follow them. Then all the abundance in Egypt will be forgotten, and the famine will ravage the land. The abundance in the land will not be remembered, because the famine that follows it will be so severe. The reason the dreams are given to Pharaoh in two forms is that the matter has been firmly decided by God, and God will do it soon. So Joseph, he interprets these dreams. He tells Pharaoh that the two dreams have the same meaning. The seven fat cows, the seven good heads of grain represent seven good, abundant harvest years. The seven skinny cows and the seven withered heads of grain represent 7 years of famine that will come immediately afterwards. And those 7 years of famine, he says, will be so severe that no one will even remember the seven good years. God told Pharaoh this dream or this message in two different ways, giving him two different dreams to emphasize that it will certainly come to pass. And now let Pharaoh look for a discerning and wise man and put him in charge of the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh appoint commissioners over the land to take a fifth of the harvest of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. They should collect all the food of these good years that are coming and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh to be kept in the cities for food. This food shall be held in reserve for the country to be used during the 7 years of famine that will come upon Egypt, so that the country may not be ruined by the famine. Joseph, he not only gives Pharaoh the interpretation of his dream, but he also then gives him a plan for surviving the coming famine. Well, where does he get this plan? I believe Joseph was given this plan by the Lord, just like he was given the interpretation of the dream. You see, the Lord has a larger plan than simply to ensure Egypt survives during this famine. This is part of a plan to raise Joseph up before all of Egypt. Joseph is going to become a national hero in Egypt. He will be highly respected by everyone, so much so that his family will be invited to come and live in Egypt, with Pharaoh giving them the territory of Goshen to live. This will all be the result of this tremendous reputation that Joseph will be given during this time when he helps this country through this famine. The plan seemed good to Pharaoh in verse 37 and to all his officials. So Pharaoh asked them, can we find anyone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God? I love that description. Pharaoh, he recognizes the presence of God with Joseph, just like Potiphar had and the prison warden had. Joseph's abilities are so extraordinary that it's obvious to each of them that God's Spirit is working through this man. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you. So Pharaoh, he proves himself to be a wise man too, because he puts his complete trust in Joseph, who he believes, listens to, and hears from God. Verse 41, so Pharaoh said to Joseph, I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his finger and put it on Joseph's finger. That ring is used to sign documents and make them officially of Pharaoh himself. He dressed him in robes of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. He had him ride in a chariot as his second in command. And people shouted before him, "Make way!" Thus he put him in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I'm Pharaoh, but without your word, no one will lift hand or foot in all Egypt." Pharaoh gave Joseph the name Zaphnath-Paneah and gave him Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, to be his wife, and Joseph went throughout the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and Joseph went out from Pharaoh's presence and traveled throughout Egypt. During the 7 years of abundance, the land produced plentifully. Joseph collected all the food produced in those 7 years of abundance in Egypt and stored it in the cities. In each city, he put the food grown in the fields surrounding it. Joseph stored up huge quantities of grain like the sand of the sea. It was so much that he stopped keeping records because it was beyond measure. So we see Joseph put into action the plan that he had proposed. And just exactly as God had predicted, they have these 7 years of amazing abundance. Before the years of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph by Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh and said, "It is because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's house and all my father's household." The second son he named Ephraim and said, "It is because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering." So he has two sons during the 7 years of abundance in Egypt, and he gives them each Hebrew names rather than Egyptian names. The first son, Manasseh, his name sounds like the Hebrew word for forget. His second son, Ephraim, his name sounds like the Hebrew word for fruitful. The names of Joseph's sons are really a beautiful summary of God's loving care extended to Joseph during this time in his life. The Lord has enabled Joseph to forget his many troubles and difficulties, and the Lord has made him flourish and prosper in the land that was to be his suffering. Finally, 57, it says, "The 7 years of abundance in Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph had said. There was famine in all the other lands, but in the whole land of Egypt there was food. When all Egypt began to feel the famine, the people cried to Pharaoh for food. Then Pharaoh told all the Egyptians, 'Go to Joseph and do what he tells you.' When the famine had spread over the whole country, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout Egypt. And all the world came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe everywhere." The Lord has put Joseph in a very interesting position, which will ingratiate him with all of the people of Egypt in a way that would not have been possible any other way. He's being looked at as their provider. He's the one who feeds them. He's the one who gives them life. He is the one who is saving them. The hearts of the Egyptians is being knit to Joseph in a very important way here. That sense of obligation and appreciation for what Joseph is doing for the Egyptian people will last for many years. Scholars estimate it to be somewhere between 60 and 100 years after the death of Joseph before the oppression of the Israelite people in Egypt will begin. In Exodus chapter 1, verse 6, it says, and this is, you know, leaping forward in time for just a moment, it says, "Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt," and that's when the oppression began. Notice how Joseph is mentioned, though, here. He is a hero in Egypt. He's a national hero because of what he's done for them. He has literally saved their lives. This is all God orchestrating this thing to put Joseph in this very important position for the good of his people. Genesis 42, the scene changes. We are back in Canaan, in the household of Jacob, Joseph's father. And in the first verse it says, when Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, why do you just keep looking at each other? I've heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die. Well, this reads kind of like the house of the Three Stooges. Or the house of the Ten Stooges in this case, because there's the ten brothers. Their father says, why are you just all sitting around looking at each other, starving to death? I hear there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some food for us before we all die. So they saddle up their donkeys and camels or whatever they've got, and they head down to Egypt. Then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others, because he was afraid that harm might come to him. So Israel's sons, or Jacob's sons, were among those who went to buy grain, for there was famine in the land of Canaan also. I want us to note that it says that Jacob did not send Benjamin, the youngest of his sons. Jacob had lost his most precious and beloved son, Joseph. He believes he's dead. The firstborn son of his beloved wife, Rachel. Her second son, Benjamin, who she had, died during the birth of, will not be taken from Jacob too. Benjamin is all that he has left of what he loves so much. He is unwilling to risk losing Benjamin. As the story progresses over the next several chapters here, we're going to see that Jacob is a man who has been broken by life's tragedies. He's not been able to really move on in life since the loss of Joseph. That crushed his spirit. His faith in God has all but evaporated. I mean, he is on life support in a spiritual sense. Verse 6, it says, now Joseph was the governor of the land, the person who sold grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their face to the ground. As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them. But he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. Where do you come from? He asked. From the land of Canaan, they replied, to buy food. Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he remembered his dreams about them and said to them, you are spies. You've come to see where our land is unprotected. When Joseph sees him, it says he remembered his dream about them. As he sees them bowing down before him, that those dreams that he had all those years ago, it comes rushing back into his mind. These ten brothers had conspired to prevent Joseph's dreams from being fulfilled. And their attempt to prevent it from happening is what ends up ensuring that it will happen. Selling Joseph as a slave is what carried him down to Egypt to begin with and connected him with the right people at the right time in the right circumstances so that this moment would come to pass. God's hand at work in our lives is amazing. It's beyond our understanding. What looks like a tragedy now can end up being an unexpected blessing later. It's so important that we trust the Lord through everything in our life, you guys. He's working even though we may not see it in the moment. When you think back all those years ago when Joseph was sold as a slave, how could anything good possibly come from that? Well, it is. We're beginning to see that beautiful plan of God unfold now. And the same thing is true in our life. Trust God with your life. "No, my lord," they answered. "Your servants have come to buy food. We are all the sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies." "No," he said to them, "you have come to see where our land is unprotected." But they replied, "Your servants were 12 brothers, the sons of one man who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father and one is no more." Whew. One is no more. I mean, those words must have pierced Joseph's heart like a knife. He's the one that's no more that they're talking about. Joseph said to them, "It is just as I told you, you are spies, and this is how you will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place until your youngest brother comes here. Send one of your number to get your brother. The rest of you will be kept in prison so that your words may be tested to see if you are telling the truth. If you are not, then as surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies." And he put them all in custody for 3 days. Well, this quickly has become their worst nightmare. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers stay here in prison while the rest of you go and take grain back to your starving households. But you must bring your youngest brother to me so that your words may be verified and that you may not die." This they proceeded to do. So Joseph, he's just this very powerful Egyptian authority in their eyes. He extends grace and kindness to them, agreeing to give them grain to take back to their hungry families in Canaan. Joseph is genuinely concerned for their well-being back in Canaan. They have just one small problem to deal with, though. One of them is going to have to stay behind in prison until the others return with Benjamin. And they're already aware of their father's reluctance to let that happen. Well, they said to one another, "Surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. That's why this distress has come upon us." Reuben replied, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? But you wouldn't listen. Now we must give an accounting for his blood." So they're having this discussion with themselves right now, speaking in their language rather than Egyptian, not thinking that Joseph and all of those around them even know what they're saying. I want us to see their guilt is eating them up. I mean, they've carried this dark secret around with them for more than 20 years. And now it comes boiling up to the surface as fresh as the day it happened. Plautus said, "Nothing is more wretched than the mind of a man conscious of guilt." It's interesting that there's no logical connection that's obvious between the events happening to them right now in Egypt and what they did to their brother Joseph back in Canaan. But a guilty conscience sees every trouble as sin's penalty. Every problem that comes into our life is interpreted as punishment for what we have done. I mean, think about it. I mean, we've all been there before. Something goes wrong on the car, and our mind immediately goes to seeing that as God bringing judgment upon us for some sin that we've committed. We fail an exam at school, and we see it as God getting back at us for our sin. There are 100 ways, our setbacks and our troubles and our difficulties that come in our life. And when we have this guilty conscience, we see it as God punishing us. He's getting us back. And that's what we see happening with these guys. A guilty conscience, it's a hard taskmaster. John Calvin said, "The torture of a bad conscience is the hell of a living soul." They did not realize, verse 23, that Joseph could understand them, since he was using an interpreter. He turned away from them and began to weep, but then came back and spoke to them again. He had Simeon taken from them and bound before their eyes. So as Joseph listens to this conversation they're having with each other about him from years ago, he sees how they're consumed with guilt and they're blaming each other even now. And it overwhelms him with emotion. He has to turn away for a time as he struggles to maintain his composure in front of them. Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain, to put each man's silver back in his sack, and to give them provisions for their journey. After this was done for them, they loaded their grain on their donkeys and left. Joseph's brothers, they still don't know who he is, that he is their brother. He does a very interesting thing here. He has the money that they had paid for the grain put back in their sack without them knowing about it. He gives them provisions for their journey. Then 27, it says, at the place where they stopped for the night, one of them opened his sack to get feed for his donkey, and he saw his silver in the mouth of his sack. My silver has been returned, he said to his brothers. Here it is in my sack. And their hearts sank, and they turned to each other trembling and said, what is this that God has done to us? Oh, that guilty conscience shows up again. They're terrified because it appears that they have been set up by that Egyptian to accuse him of stealing. Their world is coming unraveled. Things are getting worse every passing moment for them. It's interesting. See, there are other conclusions that they could have drawn from their money being returned to them. They could have seen that as a blessing, as a gift, as a gesture of kindness on the part of the Egyptian. But their guilty conscience is determined to punish them. Their guilty minds will not allow them to consider any other possibility. What is this that God has done to us? They ask. God is bringing calamity on us. We're getting what we deserve after all these years. Is God getting them back for what they did? No, he's not. He's definitely at work in their lives right now, but he's bringing healing and reconciliation and restoration and redemption into their lives. See, the story, it's not played itself out all the way yet, but the Lord has good in mind for them rather than bad. The same is true for us. We need to be careful with these intermediate points in our life. Things can look really awful, but we need to remember that we're not at the end of the story yet. The last chapters have not been lived yet. And I know, based on what this book says, that the last chapters are going to be really good ones for God's people. They're going to be really good ones for his children. See, just like this money put back in their sack, Joseph didn't do that to set them up. It's a blessing. But they can't see that. They won't allow their mind to see that. They're convinced that God is out to get them for the awful thing that they did. Verse 29, it says, when they came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them. They said, the man who is lord over the land spoke harshly to us and treated us as though we were spying on the land. But we said to him, we are honest men, we are not spies. We're 12 brothers, sons of one father. One is no more, and the youngest is now with our father in Canaan. I'm sure Jacob went, why did you say that? Then the man who is lord over the land said to us, "This is how I will know whether you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me and take food for your starving households and go. But bring your youngest brother to me so I will know that you are not spies but honest men. Then I will give your brother back to you and you can trade in the land." As they were emptying their sacks, there in each man's sack was his pouch of silver. When they and their father saw the money pouches, they were frightened. Their father Jacob said to them, "You have deprived me of my children. Joseph is no more and Simeon is no more, and now you want to take Benjamin. Everything is against me. Everything is against me." You ever felt like that? Like everything is against you? Jacob feels like the whole world has turned against him. He's lost Rachel. He's lost Joseph. He's lost Simeon. Now they want to take Benjamin from him, the only good thing left in his life. He sent his sons to Egypt for what was supposed to be a very simple errand to buy some food. "I just sent you to the grocery store, man." It was supposed to be simple. And now everything is complicated and awful. Our whole world is coming apart now. Everything is against me. The way Jacob and Joseph respond to difficulties in their lives is very different. Joseph is not like his father Jacob. Joseph faced the many difficulties in his life, seeing himself as part of God's bigger good story, and he chose to thrive wherever he was put. Jacob, on the other hand, he's clinging to the past. He lets regret and loss consume him. He fears the future. He refuses to move forward. He believes God is against him. He's lost sight of the bigger good story of God that he's part of. All of this has made him this small-minded, fearful, weak person. In his mind, everything is against him. He is a broken man. Verse 37 says, "Then Reuben, his oldest, said to his father, 'You may put both of my sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Entrust him to my care and I will bring him back.'" It's like, oh, nice. Now I'm going to lose two of my grandkids too. But Jacob said, "My son will not go down there with you. His brother is dead and he is the only one left. If harm comes to him on this journey you're taking, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in sorrow." Jacob is adamant. He is not going to risk the loss of Benjamin. They're going to have to figure something else out. We're closing there this morning. We have people wrestling with their grief. We have people wrestling with their guilt. We have people wrestling with trusting God. God is going to win. He always does. And they're going to discover that when God wins, they win too. They're going to have to trust him. And they're going to see that he's going to bring healing and redemption to this situation. And this is all part of it. You and I need to do that too, don't we? We need to trust him. Jacob, he feels like everything is against him. Maybe you feel like that today. You feel like everything that could go wrong is going wrong in your life. Your dog doesn't even like you anymore. And I want to say to you that it isn't true. Not everything is against you. Your life might be really challenging right now, but I want to remind you that God loves you and He has not forgotten you. He has not forsaken you. See, God's relationship with us is not based on karma, where everything you do is accumulating on a cosmic scale of reward and punishment. It doesn't work like that. God's attitude toward you is not dependent on your current karma score. God's relationship with you and me is dependent on Jesus Christ, who gave Himself for us so that we can be forgiven and have a brand new Father-child relationship with Him. He loves you. You are precious to Him. We might go through some difficulties in life, but we're told to look at those difficulties like it's loving discipline from our Heavenly Father, who only has good intentions toward us. Remember Romans 8:28? We know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love Him, who have been called according to His purpose. If we skip down to verse 31 of that same chapter, what then shall we say in response to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? Remember, Jacob said, everything is against me. If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare His own Son, but gave Him up for us all, how will He not also, along with Him, graciously give us all things? Let's bow our heads. Father, I want to thank You for the story of Joseph and his family, and just what an amazing testimony of Your goodness it is, Lord. And I pray for each one of Your people in this room this morning that You would encourage them, Lord, that You would remind them that You love them. And that if God is for us, who can be against us? Give us strength, Lord, as we look at these difficulties in our life. You would encourage, You would lift up, You would just come alongside and remind them of just how precious they are to You. I pray for those who have not ever received You into their life, Lord Jesus. Today would be the day that they do that, that they too can become a child of God. And these precious promises that we've been talking about today can be theirs. I pray that today is the day that they would do that, Lord. Bless each one in Jesus' name. Amen.